The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
And I think that, to me, that's the most frustrating part, is that it's a very substantial question. There is law there. There's a way of analyzing this question. Did the war on terrorism begin? You know, people have often criticized it as a war without end, but is it also a war without beginning? And that's a question the courts do and will ultimately have to decide. And the fact that at every turn, including in the military commission, that the answer has been to punt, I have to say, is frustrating as a lawyer, but it's also just frustrating as a citizen who cares about the law and thinks a lot about the law, because these are really important questions, and I just I envy other certain countries like Israel, for example, where their courts actually deal with these questions head on and unabashedly.
I'm Quinta Jurecic, and this is the Lawfare podcast, September 3rd, 2016. That was Michelle Paradis, a senior attorney in the Department of Defense's Office of the Chief Defense Counsel and counsel for Abd al-Rahim al-Nashiri. Michelle came on the podcast with Bob Loeb, a partner at Orrick, Harrington & Sutcliffe, and the former acting deputy director of the Civil Division Appellate Staff at the Department of Justice. Along with Benjamin Wittes, Michelle and Bob discussed the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals' recent ruling in the al-Nashiri case. The court denied al-Nashiri's petition for a writ of mandamus to dissolve the military commission convened to try him, and affirmed the ruling of the district court, which denied al-Nashiri's motion for a preliminary injunction of his trial by military commission. In doing so, the D.C. Circuit abstained from ruling on al-Nashiri's claim that the military commission lacks jurisdiction to try him because his alleged war crimes were committed prior to 9/11 and thus took place before the beginning of active hostilities. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 186, Geeking Out on al-Nashiri with Michelle Paradis and Bob Loeb.
So I want to start, Bob, if we can, just with as neutral a description of what the court did in the latest Nashiri decision and the nature of the dispute on the court that you can give us.
Sure, happy to do that. So this was a case argued to the D.C. Circuit back in February, where many people were waiting with bated breath to see how this comes out, because it affects not just this military commission, but perhaps a number of other commissions yet to come. So al-Nashiri is being charged in a military commission for war crimes related to his involvement in the bombing of the Sullivan and the U.S. Cole in 2000 and the Lindbergh in 2002, all predating 9/11, at least the Cole and the Sullivan. And one of the prerequisites for the military commissions having jurisdiction over these kind of war crimes in a criminal proceeding for a military crime is that the conduct here took place during armed conflict, which, you know, which is another way of saying took place during a war, but here this is an irregular armed conflict. So al-Nashiri brought an action in district court, federal district court, arguing that the military commission didn't have jurisdiction over him because his actions took place before 9/11, before the enactment of the AUMF, the authorization of the use of military force by Congress. And also he points to the fact that at the time those acts occurred, the president then said these were just acts, criminal acts. We were not at war, and that the FBI and not the military was in charge of investigating them. He made that argument to the district court. The district court refused to rule on the merits of those, saying that those kind of challenges had to await a final determination of the military commission and then review by a military appellate court before an Article III federal court got involved. Nashiri then appealed to the D.C. Circuit, challenging that, said that this is not an appropriate case for a federal court to abstain getting involved, that this is not a kind of a regular military court or military commission, which should be given the type of deference that sometimes federal courts do in the context of a court-martial proceeding. There's a regularized process where the federal courts will back off and not get involved until the very end. That's a doctrine called abstention. So the D.C. Circuit, the appellate court here, in a split decision here, affirms the decision to abstain, that not ruling on the merits of whether he's right or wrong, says that Congress has established a system of, this is not the military commissions that we saw in the Hamdan case where the Supreme Court said that it was unlawful, but also as a prerequisite for that, the Supreme Court said it's not an appropriate case to abstain because this is just an ad hoc executive branch military commission, not been set up by Congress. It's also, it's unlike the court-martial process. It doesn't involve a military officer. So the D.C. Circuit now says, well, in the Hamdan case, aren't dealing with a military office under a court-martial, so the abstention principles there don't apply. But this is very unlike Hamdan because now we have Congress and the Military Commission Act has established this military commission, set up parameters, set up the substantive crimes for it, and also has given the Article III courts a place in that process. And the bottom line there is then Judge Griffith writing the decision for the court, joined by Judge Sentell, says that it's appropriate to abstain. They also refuse to grant mandamus review, which is an extraordinary writ a court can grant to reach the merits of something early on, saying you only grant such writs in extraordinary cases where the law is very clear. And here, although they seem to say there's some substance to the arguments being raised by al-Nashiri, they say it's not an open and shut case on the merits. Judge Tatel writes a somewhat lengthy dissent in this case, saying it's not appropriate to abstain here, that really he was polite to Judge Griffith, saying this, he did a good job in trying to explain why the whole Hamdan analysis didn't apply here. But Judge Tatel really disagrees and says the abstention doctrines that we're relying here are really about the military justice system as applied to military officers and keeping order in that system, and those principles just don't apply in this context where you bring it against a third party here, such as al-Nashiri. And Judge Tatel, more interesting to me, goes on to say even when there's abstention, there can be exceptions where there's extraordinary harm or good reasons not to abstain. And here, Nashiri would be, if he's right on the merits, is basically being required to face a trial which has no jurisdiction or authority over him. And there's a harm in forcing him just through this proceeding by itself. And he goes on to say it's not that there's ordinarily a harm requiring a person to go through that kind of process. But here he cites the fact of the abuse of al-Nashiri during his early detention, during his interrogation, citing a number of government documents and a number of statements by al-Nashiri, which have now been unclassified, about the nature of his treatment, and suggests that, given the trauma that he's already been exposed to, that requiring him to sit through this entire process when there's really no authority over it is to sort of rub salt in the wounds created by the government. He doesn't reach the second mandamus issue and doesn't opine on how clear cut it is.
Okay, so Michelle, I'd like to start with a the question of why it is important to you and your client to have this jurisdictional question resolved ex ante rather than in the context of an adjudicated case. Why do you care?
I think we care for two main reasons. I think there are other reasons to care that other people should care, but the two reasons that we care are, one, you know, this is not a process that lends itself to predictability and regularity or promptness, for that matter. Al-Nashiri was first charged before a military commission in 2008. We are now at the 8-year mark of military commission proceedings against him in Guantanamo that followed 4 years of, I'll say the word, of torture by the Central Intelligence Agency in the rendition, detention, and interrogation program. And so from al-Nashiri's perspective, he has already been in U.S. custody for 14 years. Most of that has been under some of the most exacting and brutal conditions one can imagine. And so continuing on and having just this overhang of uncertainty for the foreseeable future, what's likely to be another 10 years, is a source of enormous stress for him, a source of enormous pain, because from al-Nashiri's standpoint, there is no difference between his 2006, we think of it as the time when the RDI program was closed down, but he doesn't really know that. He Guantanamo was a black site. It was a black site where he was held. It was a black site where he was tortured. And so he remains in a black site, in a proceeding whose every movement in operation apparently appears designed to kill him. And so going through that process does look to him, and I think reasonably, just like the next phase of the RDI program. And so if we can spare him that, I think just at a human level, that's an important thing to do.
But hang on, let me ask you about sort of what the null hypothesis is, because you know, the oddity of what you're requesting here is that the current proceedings, you're asking that the current proceedings stop, right? You're not asking that he be removed from Guantanamo. You're not asking, so I'm trying, and I was actually unable to tell from Judge Tatel's opinion, how exactly your prevailing, had you prevailed in this case, stops the harm that you're alleging. If you win and you get the preliminary injunction, he's still at Guantanamo. He's still in the black site as he sees it. He's still subject to something that's actually closer to the RDI program than a military commission, which is indefinite detention by, you know, a government that he does not acknowledge as sovereign. And there's actually a law that prevents him from being brought to the United States for trial. So my question is, had you prevailed here, doesn't he suffer all the same harms that you claim that he's suffering as a result of this commission proceeding?
No, actually. And let me actually get to the second point, because I think it'll answer at least a part of your question. And that is, he is under indictment presently in the Southern District of New York on capital charges relating to the bombing of the USS Cole. And so he does face, in addition to just the psychic harms of going through capital prosecution in a black site, he actually faces retrial if he prevails on this single issue 10 years from now. He faces retrial in essentially 2025 in the Southern District of New York. Now, you say, well, there's a ban on moving Guantanamo detainees to the United States. There is right now. That's debated and renewed annually. Will we still have that ban in 10 years? I kind of hope not. I think President Trump or Clinton probably hopes not, too, because certainly President Obama has taken the position that it unduly constrains his authority to make judgments about how to deal with detainees in the war on terror. So we're not even dealing here with a situation where, well, it's just one prosecution. If he guts it out, he'll be fine at the end. This is a prosecution where if he guts it out and prevails on the very issue the court didn't address here, he gets tried again in a capital trial, but this time in a federal court in an indictment that's been pending since 2002. So that's a really real harm, A, just psychically, but I think also tactically, because we don't know for sure. You gave our odds 50-50, I think, in your blog post on prevailing on this issue. But even if it's a 50-50 shot, we still have to go all out on absolutely everything and put on a proper capital defense, because that's our obligation as attorneys, especially in a capital case. So I think that's a harm that's very unique. Second, I would just momentarily push against your assumption that he doesn't recognize the sovereignty of the United States, and that if he's sort of remanded to Camp 7 without these charges, that his life will sort of continue on in perpetuity as an unlawful enemy combatant, or whatever we call them now. We obviously, for the purposes of this case, had to assume all the allegations against him were true. But having worked on this case for a pretty long period of time now, I can say that he certainly has factual defenses that have nothing to do with these legal defenses that we raised, that could very well warrant at least a meaningful opportunity to be heard in either habeas corpus or the PRBs. He is, without getting into attorney-client stuff, and everything he says to me is classified anyway, but without getting into that, he is just not like a lot of the other detainees, including some of the ones I've represented, in terms of his personality, his humanity, his attitude on life, and his politics. I'll say that much, because I can't go too much into detail, and it's probably not that interesting. The third and final piece, though, I would say, which is what makes a military commission trial much more traumatic and much more of the next phase of the RDI program than even a federal capital trial would be, is the unique nature of the military commission process in Guantanamo. For one thing, the rules are always in this constant state of flux and uncertainty. As the judge in the 9/11 case said, this is a system in which uncertainty is the norm and the rules appear random and indiscriminate. And if you have spent the past decade or more, 14 years of your life in a state of compulsory learned helplessness, where the objective was to make you 100% uncertain about every, that all of your rights are uncertain, and that was ultimately the express purpose of the RDI program, that a military trial, a capital trial, which is in which he is on trial for his life, is very much a continuation of that very specific harm that would not exist in federal court. And I would say one more thing about the rules. There are other things I could say, but there's one more thing about the rules that I think is the most important, and that is, in a federal court, evidence derived from torture is just inadmissible. And yes, there's something in the statute that says that applies in military commissions too. But the way the rules are written, particularly the way the rules are written in combination with the hearsay rules, is that unless a statement was taken under the moment of torture, it is arguably admissible as long as the government can make a case of voluntariness. So in Guantanamo, this military commission, probably not this year, probably not next year, but maybe in 2018 when we start getting to the substantive meat of this case, we're going to have a prolonged adversarial hearing on his torture, where we're going to describe and have to describe day in and day out the most traumatic and traumatizing events of his life in an adversarial setting where the government has to say, no, that didn't happen, no, he's exaggerating. And for someone who survived, someone who has undergone torture like this, which is really shocking and extraordinary, even on its own terms, that is, people talk about trigger warnings in college campuses. That is a triggering event to have to relive your torture in the context of a criminal trial where the issue is not your victimization, as it would be in any ordinary trial where torture was an issue, but whether or not your statements to interrogators can be admitted against you, and where your torture is being disbelieved by the government that's attempting to kill you. So I think those are, people can disagree and people have different fortitude, but I think all three of those are real and practical harms to him that really did put a premium on us as people who represent him and do have to not only look out for his particularized legal rights, but also his broader mental health and his ability, his humanity, to take this issue seriously, to push it as hard as we could ahead of time, because having a, what is in essence a mock trial, a mock capital trial, is a damaging and traumatizing event that should not be imposed on someone like him, where the government has already tortured him gratuitously. And that's that was really our point.
So I want to break this into two discrete conversations. Let's talk about the councilman deference abstention question. And then let's come back to the underlying question of the, of whether whenever you litigate this question, it's going to trigger, a serious jurisdictional problem for the military commission. So, Bob, you wrote in Lawfare that you were sympathetic to the majority's sense that this should. That this question, despite everything that Michelle just said, should wait until there is a conviction and to be litigated. And so my question is, both Steve Vladeck and I raised with different degrees of certainty and intensity the question of why it is desirable to abstain when the result of that is that you go through a whole capital case, you go through a whole appellate process, all the while knowing that there's some significant chance that the result of that is that you never had jurisdiction to do the first thing, the first trial in the first place. And my question is, I know these are supposed to be independent variables, but I look at it and say it's a little crazy for them to be entirely independent variables if you think that Michelle might really plausibly prevail on the jurisdictional question. And so my question is, why is this a desirable order of operations, given the possibility that the end result is just a do-over?
So let me start by not disagreeing with you on the policy perspective. I think Steve Vladeck made a powerful case for why, unlike the court-martial system, which is regularized and established, that this is, system is still finding its legs and as Michelle said, the rules seem to be changing every day and the time lags, et cetera. There's no light at the end of the tunnel exactly when this is going to come out. So for many policy reasons, you'd want to just sort of short-circuit it if, in fact, there's no jurisdiction, and the far more interesting and fundamental question is, when did the war begin, and is this an appropriate use of power? So, and as a policy matter, if you were just as, the all-powerful ruler, you could say that makes more sense to me to allow this kind of interlocutory review by the appellate courts. To me, and Judge Griffith approached it sort of under the councilman case. They had a number of factors. What did we look at when Hamdan? They looked at a number of factors as to whether a court should get involved or not. And I think on those, he didn't make the most persuasive case as to that, but you can make, I think Judge Tatel admitted that it was a sort of a novel situation, unclear as a matter of just how those particular principles play out, and I can walk through those. To me, it's sort of apples and oranges. A councilman's dealing a situation with the court-martial system. It's set up by Congress, but there's no particular role for the Article III court to come into it. And then in Hamdan, we deal with an ad hoc military commission, again, where there's no clear role for the Article III courts to come into it, although the government argued that it fell into a certain boxes with the court-martials, but the court disagreed. I see this as a completely different animal where it's a matter of just of deference. It's one thing for the courts to make up the rules and make these policy determinations where Congress is silent, but where Congress is set up, particularly the military commission system, knowing this was going to be an issue, you had to have a person be an enemy combatant, you had to have it be part of the hostilities for the conduct to be part of it, and set up a review system within the military commissions, and then Article III review, and then limited that Article III review in specific ways in the statute. I think in this context, just from my perspective as a matter of having rule of law and letting Congress make policy decisions, that the courts need to defer to that congressional judgment. And I think ultimately that's where Judge Griffith ends up, and that's his strongest trump card, and I do agree with that.
So what's wrong with that? That, like, despite all the, you know, all the verbiage, that what this really comes down to, and this was actually, I thought Judge Griffith did not make the strongest case on this that he could have. There's a pretty clearly specified procedure that Congress laid out in an elaborated statutory scheme that says exactly in what order appellate review is supposed to take place, and that doesn't contemplate, despite having been passed in response to Hamdan, which, you know, jettisoned exactly this order in exactly the way that you're describing it, it doesn't have the, and by the way, Hamdan provision that allows the sort of interlocutory appellate review that you're seeking. So, like, what's the case here for saying, basically, to heck with the order of operations, as Congress described it? And why shouldn't, I mean, if I had written Judge Griffith's opinion, it might have been much shorter, and it might have just said, hey, you know, this is what the scheme Congress laid out, tough noogies. So what's wrong with the tough noogies, argument?
So I have a sort of more legal pedantic reason, which I hoped at the time would satisfy Judge Griffith. And then also the sort of more of an equitable ground, I guess. And so I'll start with the equitable ground, because at the end of the day, abstention is an equitable doctrine, just as habeas corpus is an equitable remedy. And so to the extent making the kind of policy judgments that you were uncomfortable with is ordinarily not something we want judges to do. In the context of equity, that is actually what we're asking judges to do. We're asking judges to make a balancing of harms. And I think the harms are not, again, just to Nishiri, as I was talking about, but also to the public. When this case is ultimately before the circuit again in probably close to a decade, the family members of the victims are going to be a lot older. Many of them will probably have passed on. The question about whether or not we were at war is going to be deferred for 25 years after the ostensible beginning of that war. These are arguably questions of policy, but they're questions of legal policy that judges do take into account and should take into account. And I think just in the technical answer, which is probably more legal, is, first of all, this is actually a case a lot like Hamdan, where the question is not just constitutional. We're not just complaining about what the military commission or Congress or the president are doing. We're actually seeking to enforce a limit that Congress put. Section 950PC that we were raising says an offense is only triable if it occurred in the context of and was associated with hostilities. And so our problem in that respect isn't with Congress. We're attempting to enforce the limits Congress has imposed on the chief prosecutor and the kinds of charges he can bring. And that's where I do come back to the question of habeas corpus. This is a role that habeas corpus played in Hamdan, it played in Ex parte Kieran. There were statutes. There was the Articles of War in Kieran. There was the UCMJ in Hamdan. And the question was, are the statutes being followed? And that's a traditional use of habeas corpus.
All right. So it seems to me that you guys are much further apart on the question of the proper application of the relationship between abstention and the Military Commissions Act than you are on the policy question of, like, what should in an ideal world happen here. And so my reaction after reading the case was, the right answer here is for Congress to relax the restriction on bringing people to the United States for trial, and for the executive branch to make a very hard-headed set of decisions about whether it makes more sense in the first instance to try Nishiri under, I had actually forgotten that there was a pending indictment against him in New York, but, you know, to try him in New York under that indictment, or to proceed in the current case given the jurisdictional uncertainty. And so my question to both of you is, you know, given that the law is now in a different place than it was 2 years ago with respect to what happens absent congressional intervention, why isn't the right answer to this question for, you know, that we should take a hard look at that transfer restriction in order to free us up to ask the question whether the military commission is really in the government's best interest here and really in the defendant's best interest to the extent that anybody but Michelle cares deeply about this particular defendant's best interest.
His mother loves him.
I mean, I think everybody, I mean, this administration certainly would want to be having these as criminal trials in New York or in Eastern District of Virginia. And early on in its the Obama term, though that ability was taken away by statute, which is, you know, raises also just sort of questions of infringement on executive power and prosecutorial power. They're being forced to move ahead with these in Guantanamo, which has been difficult for both sides, and also creating a new structure from scratch, as we've seen on the habeas detainee side, and even more so on the military commission side, has been a arduous and painful process. So I think you're not going to find any opponents in this room probably of opening that up. On the question of the threshold issues, I think you could also have more modestly just suggest, I mean, it could be the Congress sees the light and allows the president to do what he wants on bringing criminal charges. You could more modestly suggest as well, maybe the issues could be certified by the military commission, or the government itself could agree to have specific issues certified to short circuit the matter, which makes what makes me uncomfortable is this is not the only threshold issue. For example, under 948C, there's a threshold issue. You can't be tried before a military commission unless, in fact, you are an alien, unprivileged enemy, belligerent, which, you know, are you an enemy combatant or not? And you have the those decisions which are challenged on habeas. One could make an argument as the defendant's counsel that that, too, needs to be litigated fully and raised before the Article III court before he's subjected to this criminal trial. So it's hard to – these are all kind of fact-bound issues. And it's hard to start picking one out that meets the standards for getting around abstention to allow the Federal Circuit, the D.C. Circuit, to get involved before Congress said it should.
So, Bob, you said there's no real disagreement that these things would be better litigated at this point in federal court. If memory serves, Nashiri was actually the case that Holder, even before the transfer restrictions, announced was the reason they were going back to Congress to redo the Military Commissions Act, because the administration wanted to proceed in a military commission. Are you, first of all, Michelle, is that right?
I think Holder said that along with four other cases after. This was when he announced the, I think I know what you're talking about, and it was when he announced the transfer of the 9/11 suspects to New York.
He announced that the
military... Yeah, so this was after the Military Commissions Act had actually been gone through again.
Gotcha.
Yes.
So, but I guess my question is, I mean, you represented the government in a lot of cases like this one, you know, a lot of Guantanamo cases. Are you convinced that if the government had the latitude to zero-base this question now, that Nashiri would be in New York or the Eastern District of Virginia and not in Guantanamo?
I think so. I think the issue back then and was more just dealing with the classified information. Mm-hmm. And we're now 10 years later, mm-hmm. and a lot more information has been declassified, and there's also more experience in working with counsel with classified information. And I think there was a belief at the time, and particularly among the intelligence agencies, about the ability and the danger that classified information would have to be disclosed and publicly disclosed in the criminal process in an Article III court. I think today there's been much more disclosure, much more declassified, that it probably is not the same issue that it was back then, but that's my speculation.
Okay, so let's turn to the elephant in the room, which is, you know, the question of, okay, you go through this whole process, either because you want to do it in a military commission or because you have to, because you can't move the guy to New York. And then either before or after, apparently it's going to be after, Michelle, you get to argue to the D.C. Circuit that, act, you know, what you in this case had to argue sort of in the mandamus context, which is that this military commission has no authority to try my guy for pre-9/11 conduct when every U.S. government official was insisting that this isn't a war. And who's ever in the Bob Loeb's former role at that point will be arguing that actually we retroactively decide when the armed conflict started based on a kind of totality of the circumstances test. So my question is, I won't ask you how confident you are that you ultimately prevail on that, because no lawyer is going to sit here and say not at all confident. But what I will ask is, you have now litigated this question in front of the military commission, in front of the district court, and in front of the D.C. Circuit. I don't know if you've ever talked about it to the CMCR, but
I don't think so. Right.
And so my question is, what is the closest any court has come to the merits of that jurisdictional question?
None. And that's, I think, the single most frustrating aspect of this case. So when we raised it in the military commission, Judge Pohl at the time decided that simply charging al-Nashiri was, in essence, good enough for government work to overcome any jurisdictional hurdle. So simply alleging hostilities in the charges was good enough for government work, and that the members ultimately will decide whether or not a war was there was a war, I guess under the totality of the circumstances. The district court punted on councilman abstention very, very summarily, actually. And the circuit did as well. I think the circuit's, so maybe the circuit is the closest to at least air both of the arguments in an opinion without making any judgment about which one is right or closer to the truth. And I think that, to me, that's the most frustrating part, is that it's a very substantial question. And I don't say substantial because we're right, necessarily, although we are. But it's a substantial question because it's a very important question. There is law there. There's a way of analyzing this question. And, you know, did the war on terrorism begin? You know, people have often criticized it as a war without end. But is it also a war without beginning? And that's a question the courts do and will ultimately have to decide. And the fact that at every turn, including in the military commission, that the answer has been to punt, I have to say, is frustrating as a lawyer, but it's also just frustrating as a citizen who cares about the law and thinks a lot about the law, because these are really important questions, and I just kind of envy, I envy other certain countries like Israel, for example, where their courts actually deal with these questions head on and unabashedly. England has had a pretty good track record about doing that as well. You may not like the results all the time, but the courts don't shy away from hard questions in the context of their own wars on terror in the same way our courts have, not just on this issue, but a number of other issues. And so I think that's the most frustrating piece of it. But the closest is probably this airing of the arguments that we got by the D.C. Circuit.
So, Bob, I'm interested in your sense of the merits of this question. I look at it and I say, as Michelle noted in my little post about this, I sort of assessed it as having a 50-50 could kind of go either way sort of way. And I can genuinely argue it to myself in either direction. When you look at it, do you have a strong sense of where you think the courts will ultimately come out on it, or do you just think it's a jump ball?
I think it's more likely the courts are going to defer to the government on their arguments about when it began. This not only touches on this on the Shiri, but also on the scope of the hostilities writ large. Is for a long period of time, the hostilities has not just been considered Afghanistan. They've also included Yemen. And why Yemen? In part because of the coal bombing there. And if you look at some of the OLC decisions regarding activities and people being focused upon in Yemen, they all sort of rely on activities in Yemen, including pre-9/11 activities and the coal bombing. So I think it's hard. It'd be hard for the courts to walk away from that and to say that they're actually all the hostilities weren't post 9/11 and were really all in Afghanistan. Although one could make a sound argument that that's the right answer. I think on one hand, Michelle's made a strong case here that you have to look at what the presidents and Congress said at the time, and that this was considered a crime and not an act of war. On the other hand, I think that sort of puts a gloss on things that now years later you have to realize the real situation. After Pearl Harbor, we said that was a criminal act by Japan, and when we're not at war with them, but that was we're going to make them pay reparations to us and bring them to world court and hold them responsible. And then they attack more U.S. ships here and more U.S. bases there. And we go, you know what? We're actually at war with them, and we've just been stupid this entire time. I think that's actually sort of the government's argument, is that, we kind of had blinders on. We were in an armed conflict, but only one of us was sort of actively fighting it. Mm-hmm. And now we are, and the AUMF officially recognized that. And on the other side, part of the government's argument throughout this litigation and detention, all that, has been deference to Congress and the AUMF, and adhere to the words of the AUMF. And AUMF talks about 9/11 and specifies that that's where things began. It does note the coal bombing and all that. But if Congress wanted to dial back the date of hostilities, it could have done that as well. So I agree with you. It's a close case. But at the end of the day, it'd be hard pressed for the courts to second guess the executive on this argument, even if it differs from what they said at the time.
Yeah, so I think you and I, in a doctrinal way, are actually very close on what the answer should be. That it is that this totality of the circumstances argument that the government's been making, that we look at it as a question of fact for a jury or a military jury to decide, is pretty, at a minimum, unprecedented, if not so unusual as to be unconstitutional. The political branches are the political branches in the area of war, because we look to Congress and the president to make those hard calls. And so to take your World War II analogy, there was the Japanese bombing of the USS Panay in the Yangtze River in 1938. And they sank one of our ships, and we've never said, oh, well, actually, hostilities with Japan began 4 years earlier, 4 years earlier than Pearl Harbor. Why? Well, I think it's because Pearl Harbor is the date, like 9/11, that lives in infamy. We had the President of the United States go before Congress after 9/11, after Pearl Harbor, and say, this is the moment. We are now at war. The nation must mobilize for that. And that has all sorts of consequences up and down the legal system. Everything from statutes of limitations in fraud cases, all the way up to military tribunals and the ability to kill American citizens overseas. And so I think where I come down, and it sort of thankfully marries with the position we've taken in this case, is that we have one president at a time, we have one Congress at a time, and we look to them to determine whether or not the events in the world have thrust us into this secondary legal regime that is the law of war.
As a matter of deference to Congress, the one thing that I think Judge Griffith pointed to, which was fairly strong, was that in the Military Commissions Act itself, it speaks to jurisdiction over conduct before, on, or after September 11th, 2001, which shows that Congress there, at least in creating the military commissions, understood there was going to be some pre-9/11 conduct that was going to be swept in as far as war crimes under the military commissions. And given that al-Qaeda declared war years earlier, It makes sense that Congress was thinking about things like the coal attack when it did that.
So I want to throw out one idea for you both to reflect on or bounce off or tell me why I'm wrong, and then we can wrap up. So my question is, first of all, on the government's position on this strikes me as it almost has to be wrong, because leaving a court's jurisdiction to the trier of fact, to the extent that the trier of fact is a jury, or in this case, members of the commission, I can't think of a single example of a place where the court's jurisdiction is left to as a matter of factual finding of the ultimate decider of fact. But conversely, I say, well, the political branches say all kinds of things. And normally, when we're looking at the question of whether an armed conflict exists, there's actually an international law definition of an armed conflict. It looks to, duration, intensity, scope and magnitude of hostilities. So why isn't the answer to this question to evaluate from an international law point of view whether, in fact, the conditions at the time of the coal bombing did or did not meet the international law definition of an armed conflict, and treat that as a threshold jurisdictional question that is not about, as you would argue, the statements of the political branches, which it could turn out to be blinded or, but similarly, doesn't require the ultimate discretion of a bunch of jurors.
On your point about that, there's these threshold things, questions shouldn't be factual questions that go to the military commission to decide itself. I mean, they're often going to be factual issues, even in a court martial, as to whether some crime was related to the military, and that's and military conduct such that it's appropriate before a court martial. But you're right. This is a more fundamental question as to when the war began. And I raised the point in my post the other day. It could be the government would just be better off not having a totality approach from the commission determining it, and not having it from an international law perspective, where judges, an Article III judge, is going to decide, looking at his understanding of the restatement and what law professors have said is when armed conflict should begin, and instead embrace the notion that this is a political, when a war begins and when a war ends is a political fact and is not subject to court review at all. And that we know that the Supreme Court has said as to when an armed conflict is over, that the courts actually don't have a role, that it's considered a political question that the courts can't review. And one, I think, can sensibly take the same position, and from the executive authority standpoint may want to take such a position, to say that really whether it's an armed conflict has begun or not comes to Congress declaring with AMF that it's begun, or the president saying that we're at war. That's a political statement, and that's a contemporaneous one, not a historical one 20 years later. And then that doesn't leave it to the foibles of what an Article III judge thinks 10 or 15 or 20 years later, and also recognizes it should be an executive determination, which should be due deference by the judiciary. So I would take it a step further. I don't think it should be part of a fact-finding, and I don't think it should be something that an Article III judge, it should be a executive determination that's been made by the president. And then the good question is it the president now, or is it the president contemporaneously? And then I think that's where you go to question whether it's a coin flip on which president you're going to defer to. Mm.
Yeah, I think we're unfortunately in violent agreement about that, because it is. It's a question where you need clarity and you want political accountability. If the president makes the wrong call about there being a war or not, we should be able to vote him or his party or his heir apparent out of office. In same thing with the Congress. If we think Congress has let the AUMF run on too long, we should be able to vote them out of Congress on that basis. And if we think that Congress is not taking full accountability and responsibility for things like the war in Syria or U.S. activities against ISIS, we should be able to vote them out on that basis and say, look, we need to have much more clarity about when and where the United States is at war because it's so consequential. I tend to be in violent agreement with you. I think international law standards are relevant and interesting and from an international law perspective, but when it comes to how the Constitution allocates the power of the Commander-in-Chief and the power of the Congress to declare war, I think as a constitutional matter, it makes sense both textually but also democratically to make those political decisions because they're so fundamentally political, and it can often be a very, very close call.
One thing that Al Nashiri's, this panel decision may not be the final word on the abstention or on this point on mandamus as to the as to how close a question this is. The D.C. Circuit, since I left Department of Justice 3.5+ years ago, has undergone an infusion of liberal judges, which really makes it a very different court. And we have here a conservative majority ruling on abstention in a way that that has a lot of holes as to its rationale, which some of them were poked by Judge Tatel. And Judge Tatel does come down very hard on the abuse torture issue and sort of raising that as an additional reason why you have to have review of this issue now and not later. And the fact also that the majority doesn't even make a very strong convincing case about on the when hostilities began issue too, just makes this a very important and very interesting case that the D.C. Circuit could decide to hear in bank. So right now there's a period of 45 days, I think, to petition to the court that they can sit, a full court and all the active judges can sit to hear the case. And given its current makeup, there may be a, if you would make a petition for that 3 or 4 years ago, it would have gone nowhere. Today, there may be a desire in that court to actually get more involved in some Guantanamo cases and to confront the issues of torture, confront the issues of the authority of the military commission.
On that forward-looking note, we will end. Thank you both for joining us. And I have a feeling we're just going to have a lot of opportunities to come back to both this and other such cases.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan, who does her best to be charitable, even to her worst enemies.
His mother loves him.
And as always, please spread the word and promote the Lawfare podcast via your social networks on Twitter, Facebook, and email. This week, we're also celebrating Lawfare's 6th birthday. If you enjoyed this podcast and like what we do, please consider giving us a donation. Details are on our website, lawfareblog.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
A little something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional, unprofessional. So if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.